Here in Honolulu tomorrow morning, Hawaii Supreme Court justices will be taking up the second of two cases appealed to the High Court. Joining us today is HPR reporter Ku'uwe Hirohishi, who will be in the courtroom with more on What's on Tap. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So tell us more about this case.
So this case, commonly known as the Flores case, or Flores versus the Board of Land and Natural Resources and University of Hawaii, this is about Mr. Kalani Flores, who is a cultural practitioner and educator from the Big Island, who requested a contested case hearing with regards to the sublease that University of Hawaii has with the 30-meter telescope. That contested case hearing request was denied by BLNR, and Mr. Flores appealed, and the Environmental Court of the Third Circuit agreed with Mr. Flores that he should be entitled to a contested case hearing. And so BLNR and UH had appealed that to the High Court, and that's where we find ourselves today. So the question is really whether Mr. Flores is entitled to a contested case hearing.
So you reached out to them.
I did. I reached out to Mr. Flores, spoke to him this morning. He seems to be in good spirits, but we also got to talk to the attorney, David Koila Copper, over at the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation to kind of summarize what this case is really about.
Well, this case is really about the rights of Native Hawaiians to have a voice in state decision-making when those decisions could affect their cultural resources or Native Hawaiian traditional customary practices.
And also for this story, so this idea of taking into consideration traditional and customary rights of Native Hawaiians in state decision-making was a big theme of the previous contested case hearing, which we all followed, a 44-day-long contested case hearing on the conservation use district permit. So that particular case has been appealed to the Supreme Court, but the same idea of taking in all the testimony from practitioners and people that will be affected by the development, that is something that is at the center of this Flores case as well. But the difference is that this case is about the sublease and not the district use permit. So the sublease has all the pretty much the nitty-gritty on money that's being paid, how that particular development is going to be utilized and what they're going to be giving back. So it's less about the land itself and more about the business side, I guess, of this TMT decision.
So it's interesting that the lower courts have said, not so fast.
Yes, and that happened in both cases, right? So the conservation district use permit was also invalidated by a lower court and made its way to the Supreme Court. Same thing we're seeing here. So these legal proceedings are actually just sort of a backdrop, because I think the bigger question that is on everyone's mind is this looming April deadline. And so we're coming down to the wire for the 30-meter telescope, but the TMT board has made it very clear over the past several months that April 2018 was going to be the month to decide whether to build on Mauna Kea and continue their efforts to sort of seek resolutions in these legal proceedings or to relocate to the Canary Islands. And it's been an interesting move, because right now TMT has already put up a website for the TMT La Palma. They've made field visits. They are actively trying to get things ready in case of a possible pullout of Mauna Kea. But in speaking to some of the supporters of TMT, including Richard Ha, a businessman from the Big Island and one of the most staunch advocates for the telescope, they are not worried about a possible pullout. I guess a lot of the sentiment behind his feeling that way is the investment that TMT has already been making in funneling funds. They've put funds into education on the Big Island. They have done a lot of outreach work. So for people like Mr. Ha, this April deadline is not too big of a worry. And in speaking with folks over at, I guess, opponents of the telescope, Ke Aloha Peshoda is one of probably the headlining opponent of it. She expressed the possibility that April is coming, but she's not sure that April was a hard deadline. To her understanding, it was, she called it, it was a threat in some ways. that they wanted, TMT wanted to have a decision made faster. But she's saying that no matter what happens, she would like to ensure that if TMT does go to La Palma in the Canary Islands, that they do the same thing in terms of taking in consideration of the people there and what the impacts will be of the 30-meter telescope.
It's really interesting, though, because we do have legislation moving at the state capitol to try and create an agency or take the power away from UH and DLNR. What do you think about that?
Right. Senator Kai Kahele's and I guess Donovan de la Cruz, their efforts to sort of figure out a middle way or figure out a better management policy coming forward, I think that's really one of the biggest impacts of this entire process and sort of questioning and reanalyzing what it is we're doing up on that mountain and how we can ensure a management plan that takes into consideration everyone and everything that could be impacted by further development.
Right. So all these side issues, you know, we saw the one thing in court raise the issue of speaking Hawaiian in court and providing interpreters. So certainly a lot of the importance on the cultural aspects are coming up just on the periphery of this whole TMT controversy.
I think, yeah, the activism that's resulted from something like this, which, you know, it sort of had this ripple effect in the community for sure, in the Native Hawaiian community, in terms of making people aware of what laws are in place to protect certain rights and what can be used. And I think we've seen a lot of that through these legal proceedings. I'd say 30 years ago, there probably would not have been as many legal proceedings as we've had today in terms of it's been a 10-year, nearly decade-long battle for TMT to try to build this telescope, and they've stuck with it, and so have the opponents. So it will be interesting to see what happens next. I mean, April is just 18 days away, and if they stay or if they go, we don't know yet.
Right, and it is kind of curious because, you know, with all this talk about the cultural practices and respect for the culture, there's also a lot of focus on the good science that's happening up at the telescope. And a lot of young people are learning more about the programs, possible careers, and there's been lots of emphasis on that as well.
Yes, that's exactly what the TMT has been sort of funneling money and trying to support is this pipeline for TMT and all the telescopes, there are 13 up on Mauna Kea, to be a place of learning for Native Hawaiian students and future careers for Native Hawaiians as well.
Have you been up there?
I have. I always lose my breath, though. It's so it's so high up there, but it is beautiful and spectacular. And I think anyone who's following this case would really gain a lot from having that experience themselves.
Yeah, I've been up there once, but I would love to go back again.
We should.
Thank you very much, Kuvei Hirishi. Our reporter, Kuvehi, will be in the courtroom tomorrow, and we will see what happens. You can follow her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org and click on the news tab. Years ago, Bear Stearns starting to wobble sparked a chain of events.
It was a very, very interconnected, intertwined web of commitments, like a house of cards.
I'm Molly Wood, where the house of cards may be hiding now, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, studying the spread of fake news on social media. But first, your quiz.
Mm-hmm. Maui, o Kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
In today's backyard quiz, we're jumping into the Wayback Machine to take a closer look at Lanai's sugar history. In the 1990s, the Mauna Lea Sugar Company set up shop along the island's eastern shore. Business boomed and operations expanded quickly with the addition of 500 plantation laborers, turning a once sleepy fishing village into an agricultural hub. Business continued successfully until the 1900s. That was the year the plague, which had originated on Oahu, hit the plantation. What was worse, the freshwater resources that irrigated the fields had turned brackish, forcing Mauna Lea Sugar Company to shut down operations in 1901. For today's quiz, can you name the village that was once home to Lanai Sugar? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, this is Jim Moffat. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Chronic 911 callers. Some call for help nearly every day. A couple of years ago, emergency officials flagged the growing problem with some patients who would call to be transported to hospitals a staggering 100 to 200 times a year. Dr. Jim Ireland was the head of the city's emergency medical services back then. He tried out a pilot to try and be proactive so valuable resources wouldn't continue to be diverted for trivial calls. This session, the issue is back before lawmakers, this time to fund a program for community paramedics for a longer period, not just to save money, but to save lives.
Rather than just answering these calls day after day and tying up ambulances from, you know, downtown was causing Hawaii Kai, Aiea, Kailua to have to come into town to answer all these calls because there were dozens and dozens of calls, we thought, let's have a pilot. It was unfunded, but for a month, let's just engage these callers that are calling all the time. And there were some challenges because a lot of them we couldn't find because they were moving around. I'd say maybe, if I remember right, 80% were homeless, not all. But we would engage them and find out why they were calling. Do you need a primary care physician? Do you need some mental health services? Do you need to know how to get care other than 911 in the emergency room? And just by doing that, we did make some progress.
And so right now we've got a couple of bills at the legislature trying to, maybe make this a permanent program or at least fund it going forward?
I think the plan is for a funded pilot to see how it works in kind of a more organized fashion, I think overseen by the state health department. And Jim Howe, who's now the director of emergency services, when he testified about this bill, he likened it to what lifeguarding was and is. Before, very reactionary, would respond to drownings. Currently, very proactive, going out, engaging people before they got in the water, warning them of risks. And this is similar to what I think this bill would do. Rather than answering 911 calls, taking people to ERs, for those people who are using 911 a lot or using it inappropriately, go out and engage them, find out why they're calling, and then help them to come to a solution, you know, partnering with community health centers, mental health, and other services that are there, but maybe they just aren't connected with them.
So how did you do the pilot originally? Did you have a team that volunteered to say, okay, we'll go out and connect with these folks, network with them?
It was essentially two people, and they had been injured, so they couldn't work on an emergency ambulance. But they could definitely do medical care and go see people. They just couldn't lift people and bring people downstairs and that sort of thing. They volunteered. It was a special assignment. We took an old ambulance. We repainted it so it didn't look like the normal one. And they went out and engaged people. And again, connected them under medical direction, supervised by a physician, and just connected people with more appropriate care. ERs are great for emergencies, but they're not great for relationships and ongoing medical issues like diabetes and hypertension and mental health, because it's a patch and it's not meant to be an ongoing thing. And that's what some people were using it for.
And there was a time when I think the medical school was helping to reach out to some of those Kakaako encampments to deal with some of the minor stuff.
And I believe they still are, and that is an excellent program. And when we thought of this, is how could we partner with the medical school, the School of Nursing, social work, and even make a multidisciplinary team. One thing that I think is a little, and really anybody can do this with a medical background. Physicians can do it, nurses, nurse practitioners. But what's appealing to me about the paramedics is they know the streets. They know where people hang out. They're used to going and caring for people under bridges in just places that, for me who work in a clinic, it's just very foreign. So that's why I think the community paramedic was a push for that, because I think they're the ones who, of all the medical providers, know the streets. These would be teams that were not tasked with regular 911 care, totally separate, and not even in the 911 system per se. So it would avoid that problem of pulling 911 crews to take care of kind of these engaged, proactive approaches. And at the same time, every person you prevent from calling 911, especially inappropriately, you save an ambulance to be ready for what we call a true emergency. Now, everybody's definition of an emergency is different. But when I think of emergencies, I think of chest pain, shortness of breath, asthma attacks, allergic reactions, and injuries, whether it's from falls or car accidents. Needing a sandwich is not an emergency. Medicine refill, very minor scrapes, sprains. Generally, those aren't emergencies. Although people don't know and they may call for them, and you know, we go to the scene and we educate, and if they want to go to the hospital, we take them. But when that happens from the same person every day, 6 days, 7 days a week, that's a problem. And it hurts everybody, not just the people, like you said, in that region. But if Hawaii Kai is coming into town for these minor calls, then Hawaii Kai is deprived of their ambulance.
And what about the cost and the strain of dealing, you know, with these cases, the frequent flyers?
And that's a whole nother thing. What's interesting is, you know, we look at what's best for patients, what's best for their health, what's best for patient care, and keeping ambulances available for other people. But the cost is a whole nother issue. And the cost of an ambulance, it's, you know, I don't know the exact cost, but it's around $1,000. Going into the ER, it can be $1,000 or more, depending on what tests are done. And by the time things are said and done, that could be a $5,000 bill for a very minor complaint. Whereas if you were to go to a primary care provider, it might be $50. So using 911 and ERs over and over again for minor complaints is a huge waste of money. It's not better care. And ultimately, I'd say, you know, majority of folks who you do this frequent flying, frequent callers, are under government health insurers like Medicaid. And so ultimately, we pay for that. You, me, everybody who pays taxes are the ones who are paying for this extra cost. And so a small investment in a program like community paramedics, I think, would pay off tenfold in savings.
And the support that you're seeing at the legislature, how is that?
I think there's interest, and I think people are aware and are becoming aware of the problem of not enough ambulances, and part of it is because of frequent callers. And so I think people see this as something that could be very helpful.
You think of like one particular case that maybe stands out?
I can think of a few. One in particular was a woman who was not homeless. She lived in Waikiki, and she did not have a primary care physician. So when she needed a medicine refill or she had a problem or needed any kind of medical care, her response was, let's call 911. She went to the ER, got whatever she needed, and then was good for another week or two or month, and then she would call again. And her whole, and I don't think she drove, but by connecting her with the Waikiki Health Center, our community paramedics did that. They helped with their social worker arrange transportation, I think it was handy van or something, and she connected with them. And in a six-month period before they met her, she called, I don't know, something like 30 times, maybe something like that. It wasn't horrible, but it was a lot. And the 6 months after, it was maybe one time. And so one case, but that was one. Another couple is where we engaged some homeless patients who were calling a lot and just, again, directed them to the Waikiki Health Center because that's what's in Waikiki and helped them with their, I think one of them had chronic pain, needed pain medicines, and they got him taken care of with that. And he just didn't have to call as much. And so I think more than anything, not only do they treat patients, but they're connectors. The community paramedics are connectors. They connect to more appropriate care, whether it's mental health or community health care, primary care, so people don't utilize the emergency rooms.
Right. And then because we've had a lot of focus on the problem of homelessness, I would think, though, that lawmakers would be hard, you know, pressed to say no to something like this when they know ultimately it helps everybody in the community.
I agree. And there's a lot of priorities at the legislature. And I know that, a lot of people ask for funding for different programs. And, you know, I know EMS is asking for another ambulance for Oahu, and that's more funding. You know, I know there's a lot of asks, but this, I think, is worthy. And ultimately, I think it'll save money. So better care, saving money. The other thing that I think that this will potentially address is people who don't get regular and good health care that live on the streets have horrendous wounds. And these wounds are often infected, and they're bathing in places like, you know, beach park bathrooms. And there's a real risk that public and other people can get MRSA, these resistant bacterial staph infections and other things. And so I think the community paramedics will also address that. You know, if you have a wound, getting them on the right antibiotics, getting them to the proper care to get the wound cared for, and then coupled with the city's new hygiene centers, I think that is ultimately a public health issue, but that's something I think that they will be helpful in addressing as well.
That was Dr. Jim Ireland, former director of the city's Emergency Medical Services, talking about the need to manage the problem of chronic 911 callers. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation. Power struggle at the Honolulu City Council doesn't bode well for Honolulu's Mayor Kirk Caldwell and the rail project, as Ernie Martin, one of the biggest critics of both, is preparing to retake the reins as City Council Chairman. Honolulu Civil Beat's Marcel Henry has a story about just that. Good morning, Marcel.
Morning, Catherine. Good to be here.
So, lots of intrigue. Cloak and dagger.
Yeah, we've seen some really interesting developments since this past Friday. You've got, you know, your palace coup, your political intrigue, your power struggle, and it really sets up a lot of questions for rail's future and basically how the project is going to be funded on the city side.
Right, and it's just kind of curious that the reasons I know that City Council Member Kim Pine has given for her switch support from Ron Manor to Ernie Martin.
Yeah, that was really telling. You know, there was an interesting, semi-unrelated press event yesterday, a signing for the city's monster home bills, and Kim Pine, the councilwoman, joined Mayor Kirk Caldwell and her colleague on the council, Akaika Anderson, really to talk about this bill signing. At the event, it was really kind of interesting. She kind of went off script and started talking about how last week was International Women's Day and basically alluding to women members on the city council not getting the proper credit for their work on legislation and having their legislative bills copied into other legislative bills like the Monster Home bill. So a lot of the issues that we've been seeing starting to come to light really poured over in even just, you know, official events like this signing.
Right, because I know both Carol Fukunaga and Ann Kobayashi were out early on with their ideas about how to curb this problem, and really a lot of those ideas got folded into the final legislation that got signed by the mayor.
Right, there was originally a Bill 94. The bill that was being touted yesterday was Bill 110, but Kim Pine came out and was touting Bill 94 and in subsequent interviews made very clear that this was a big reason why she's shifting from Ron Manor, the current chairman, his power block, to help restore the former chairman, Ernie Martin, back to power in the city council. And this has a lot of implications for rail policy at the city going forward.
Right. And the snub, though, is interesting because Kim Pine supports rail, and her constituents out in the district, want another way into town.
She does. And they do have to be kind of careful. They are looking to provide a check and to ask tough questions, as they put it, and not be a rubber stamp, as they also put it, for Mayor Kirk Caldwell on rail. And really to kind of, tighten the screws there, but at the same time, not to jeopardize the project. And Kim Pine she said yesterday, it was kind of interesting, one of the first things she said to me is, I find it insulting, was the word she used, that the mayor and other members of council would suggest that this shuffle and this shakeup could impact the rail project. So we'll have to see how it goes.
Right, and we will see how the feds are looking at this latest development as well. There's also legislation at the Capitol where the state lawmakers, are eyeing the pot of money that gets collected for the rail money. So you're going to have some very interesting heart meetings to cover.
Yeah, the drama just continues with rail, even when you think it stopped.
All right. Okay, thanks a lot, Marcel.
Thanks, Catherine.
We regularly bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. We were talking to Civil Beat's reporter, Marcel Henre. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
With her three kids in the back of the minivan, Ellie Diaz is driving through a tunnel of flames.
Okay, I can do this.
But the next minute,
I would be like screaming, oh my God, we're gonna die. Like, please God, let us live.
Why weren't they warned? California's deadliest wildfires on the next Reveal.
This evening at 7.
With so much turmoil and drama at the White House these days, you'd think there wouldn't be a need to make things up in the world of politics. Neil Milner joins us in the studio this morning. He's here to tell us about a recent study out of MIT that tells an interesting tale about fake news and other drama. So what's up, Neil?
Well, lots of things are up, and you have to understand this is not at all just about this White House. It's not at all just about political news. It's a study done by three MIT scientist about Twitter and news passing through Twitter. And one of these scientists was formerly one of the big scientists at Twitter itself. So what they did, they were interested in seeing the path of true news versus false news. So the first thing they did was to take every news Twitter, 128,000 of them, from the inception of Twitter till midway into the 2016 presidential campaign. They used fact-checking services to rate whether they were true stories or false stories. And they had a good – these are a little bit arbitrary, but the fact that they all showed about the same thing. Then they studied the threads of these things. So the upshot was this. False news has more impact than true news. It travels faster. It travels deeper. False news travels 70% faster than true news and gets to a lot more people. We're talking about 3 to 4 million people becoming part of this thing. And that really was the upshot of the finding. It's a pretty thorough study, but it's a very numerical kind of statistical studies. And there's certain things that you're probably going to ask me, like, why does it work this way, that they could only say very little bit about.
Now, some people might be surprised at the findings. Some people might be depressed. I mean, it's just so disheartening.
Well, it may be disheartening, but it also fits into a pattern of things that we've begun to understand much more clearly, which doesn't make it pleasant, about the way people think about news. remember the recent, I've talked about this on and off during these shows over the course of the last couple of years, that first of all, people don't exactly approach the analysis of a piece of news, and this is not all newspaper news, but any kind of piece of news, in a sort of objective manner. They're looking for things that support them. We know the power of the story, and we also know from what's been on, what I've talked about before on here, that there are kind of sound emotional reasons why people don't have much of a truth filter, at least initially. They see things. And so, in a sense, what we've begun to worry about a lot more in terms of the Trump administration and in terms of social media is not all that different in terms of the way people respond to things. As they, you know, you and I have talked before about people here loving political gossip, and it seems like getting the dish on someone seems to be more important than whether the information is true or not. So there clearly is that kind of thing. The scientists who did the study said, in effect, look, the only way you can find out with any depth about why people think this way is through a whole very different kind of process of investigation, talking to people, interviewing them. We can't do it. But what we can show on the basis of this study is that novelty seems to have a lot to do with it. People respond to the novelty of the false story. And you can see that when they look at words that the people use, surprise, fear, all those kinds of things, as opposed to true stories, which are a little bit more delight and trust. But if you think about watching a movie, right, I think about this in terms of watching movies, right, that this kind of disgust and fear and surprise is a very powerful kind of thing. So they say novelty has a lot to do with it. They don't have really the faintest idea how you change this, and they're pretty honest about this, other than to say, be careful.
So it sounds like you're saying facts are boring.
Well, I think, but see, people don't make that distinction between, there's something to a false story. And remember, people don't know it's false. There's something in these stories that grabs people's attention. And I have an easier time getting an understanding of this if I think about storytelling generally, or if I think about comedians, you know, doing sketch comedy, where there's a kind of believability, or even science fiction, there's a kind of believability here that captures people's attention, that brings them in. And it may be that false stories do that better than true stories.
But when you think about the consequences of that, particularly in a political campaign, and we've seen over the years how people have lost races because of some smear campaign, something that came out last minute and the candidate didn't have time to respond. And some of it was pretty, you know, they're saying, oh, it's juicy.
Do you have any local examples in mind?
Yeah. CSEPTEL.
Sure. Well, we never know how much impact they really have, first of all, but they're clearly part of the bag of tricks, the toolbox that gets used here all the time. And, you know, this is way prior to social media. It's almost prior to television, for goodness sake. So those things are there. But I think what we have to understand about people's reaction to voting and to politics is that, and I get this from a very definitive book called Democracy for Realists, there is very little link between what people think politicians do and what they in fact do. So in a sense, it's not like the rails are suddenly coming off the track. What we have now are media communications kinds of things that can move much faster along these kinds of lines. And we also have a president who is more than willing to use this kind of thing to his disadvantage and who, frankly, doesn't really think very much about the distinction between truth and lies. So I don't want people to be under any illusion that we've suddenly become this way. The context may have changed and the politics may have changed, but at its base, I think this is very much in line of what I would have expected, given what else we know.
Okay, you're not surprised. Share with us how these Boston researchers decided to go down this road.
Well, that's a sad and interesting story. At least two of them were sheltering in place in Boston in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing. If you remember, the bombers, the perpetrators were on the loose, and the authorities set the shelter in place. And so these guys, these scientists, were getting their information while they were sheltering in place through Twitter. And afterwards, at least one of them, and probably both of them initially, the third person comes in later, began to think about the fact that they started looking at these stories and said most of them are false, that essentially we were operating on the basis of false information. Now, they certainly understood the context was different. This is a crisis context. But it got them interested in looking at, in a very comprehensive way that's never been done before, what the difference is in the impact of true stories and false stories. So that's how they got into it. And the third one got brought into it because he was a graduate student, and they got him to do some of the research.
Well, I remember when this was because it was a breaking story, that some of the media outlets were reporting folks who were possible suspects, person of interest, and they got some bad information.
Oh, yeah.
That was scary.
It was scary, and that's such a fluid situation. What we're talking about in the average tweet is not something as much as that. I want that to be very clear. It's not they were just doing crisis situations. They had this large, comprehensive 128,000. And this is true, by the way, for all stories, not just political stories, business stories, entertainment stories. False ones had a bigger spread. More people were interested in them and spread them along than true stories.
Right. So the bottom line is what? It's accuracy, isn't it? Be careful.
Well, that's what one of the researchers said this. He said, look, all I can really say at this moment, they have some ideas about incentives to do things a different way. When you read stuff, be careful. Do fake news. Be literate about what's called fake news. By the way, they never used the term fake news. They said it's become totally politicized, not very useful.
Okay, be careful what you retweet, if you're tweeting.
Be careful what you retweet and do some media literacy. But remember how hard media literacy is to do. It's not just learning a skill. It's getting our brain to operate differently.
All right, thank you, Neil.
You're welcome.
Neil Milner is retired professor of political science and contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation.
Hi, I'm Gary Epstein, a theatrical talent agent from Phoenix Artists in New York City, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the show, we looked at Lanai's sugar history. The eastern coastline was a bustling hub of industry in the 1890s. Population jumped from fewer than 200 to 900 after the Mauna Loa Sugar Company brought in workers to cultivate the fields. The thriving plantation also boasted a newly constructed pier and railroad. Unfortunately, prosperity didn't last long. The plague of 1900 was brought from Honolulu and hit this area really hard. And to make matters worse, the fresh water used to irrigate the fields turned brackish. According to local lore, Mauna Loa sugar brought on the ill fortune after construction of the railway displaced sacred stones of a heiau. Today, not much remains. Visitors can still catch glimpses of train tracks, the renovated Malamalama Church, and at low tide, two of Lanai's ancient Hawaiian fish ponds. And just imagine what the once successful sugar town of Keomuku looked like. We have a winner. Jock Sims called us from Afghanistan. He's listening to us on the web. Congratulations, Jock Sims. He lives in Waimanalo when he's in town. That is today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping to prepare students for the SBA exam with topical content and practice for the types of questions found on the test. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
West Hawaii's latest water woes seem to be a real head-scratcher. Our contributing reporter, Sherry Bracken, is keeping a close eye on the situation after a fourth well failed Friday.
They say that nobody has had any shortages, and frankly, they're lucky. As I've mentioned in the past, we got way more rain than usual between summer and fall, because usually our rain stops in the fall, and we're getting rain in the winter, too. I mean, it's raining right now. It's been raining for a couple of days, so they're very lucky that way, because the biggest user of water is really irrigation.
But
that doesn't negate the fact that they have three wells out of service, just lost another one last Friday, and they still have no idea why any of the wells are failing.
Well, that's a little distressing, though.
It's extremely distressing. And the distressing part is also going to lead to definitely increases in our water rates.
You
can't keep buying things without paying for them. I talked with the Department of Water Supply Chair, Keith Okamoto, on Tuesday morning, and I talked with his deputy last Friday, because last Friday morning, a water well, the Honokahau well in North Kona, failed again. And this is a well that had only been in service since October 2017. And then Friday morning, March 9th, it failed again. And again, the Department of Water Supply has no idea why the well failed.
Do they plan to bring someone in to give them another set of eyes on the situation?
Well, the Department of Water Supply, Keith Okamoto, they say they have done that. They've hired outside experts who also don't seem to be able to get to the bottom of the problem. And when I interviewed Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim in January, he concurred that he was talking with the Army Corps of Engineers to see if they could offer some guidance and assistance. And when I spoke with Keith Okamoto on Tuesday this week, he said the Army Corps of Engineers essentially indicated this kind of water well issue is not really their kuleana. So, yes, the Department of Water Supply says they're bringing in experts, but so far nothing has changed. They continue to lose wells, and at this point, unless something's happened and I don't know about it, we have three wells in North Kona out of service, and it's only North Kona wells that are failing, not wells other places on the island.
And what's the normal water usage in that area?
The normal water usage, Keith has told me, can be as high as 12 million gallons a day. Normal usually hovers between 10 and 11 million gallons per day. But between previous conservation, which was 25%, and now they're asking for 10% conservation, Keith Okamoto says that we are at about 8.5 million gallons per day. So people in North Kona are conserving, there's no question. And that is a good thing, just in general principles, but it shouldn't be because we're losing wells.
Now, you had previously talked about a citizens advisory board that was helping, the county board of water supply. What's happening on that level?
Okay, that is correct, and it's officially called a Permitted Interaction Group, or PIG. Why they arrived at that name, I don't know. But the report from that group is due at the next Water Board meeting, March 27th. I've talked with Craig Takamine, the chair of the Water Board, and he doesn't want to share their conclusions, the conclusions of this group, until they present them formally. And so I'm really eager to see what happens on March 27th. Although Keith Okamoto told me he met with that board, that citizens advisory group, and he told them that already what the Department of Water Supply has decided to do is try to standardize the wells more, because at this point every single one is different, because most of them came to the Department of Water Supply from developers. They're looking at wells with lower capacity. They're looking at better power and temperature monitoring, because most of them did not have temperature monitors, and just basically smaller well capacity. Keith thinks that might be a solution.
When they say the wells fail, can we get them to be more specific than that? Is it the pump? What's
There's
going
the
on?
Rub. Essentially, the symptom is they stop pumping water. The question is what the problem is. And Keith said in the Honokahau well, by the way, an interesting thing about this most recent failure, the Honokahau well, even though it went in new in October 2017, Keith told me 2 months ago they were running the well at less than its full capacity of 1.4 million gallons per minute. They were running between 700,000 and 1 million gallons per minute, because they had concerns over rising temperatures, and rising temperatures are not a good thing for pumps and motors. And I asked him on Tuesday if they had done that, because they suspected it was going to fail, and He said, no, they just wanted to be cautious. And they have determined that the failure is not topside, and it's somewhere down in the shaft, either the cable or the pump or the motor or the well, but they haven't pulled it out of the ground yet.
So what kind of backup equipment do they have once they maybe identify the offending part?
Well, they, I shouldn't use well, it sounds like I'm making a pun. They generally do not have backup equipment. In the case of the Honokahau well, they had already ordered backup equipment. Again, he said, not because they thought Honokahau would fail, but just because they wanted to have backup. But the backup equipment for Honokahau will not arrive here until the middle part of 2018. So we're looking at least 3 or 4 more months of the Honokahau well, and it's 1 million gallons per minute pumping being out of service.
So we just have to keep praying for rain until they get to the bottom of this.
Well, rain helps a lot because of the irrigation, because irrigation, I discovered, even in my own water usage, is a huge water user. But the other thing is that people have cut back, have conserved, and Keith says that his department is now much better at balancing water, at moving water from place to place. So he says because of these outages, nobody has been out of service.
Well, that's a good thing.
It is a good thing, but the best thing would be if they could find and fix the problems, because although the Department of Water Supply has not yet raised rates, Craig Takamine, chair of the board, told me that he believes they probably will have to, and logic would tell you if they're buying all this new equipment that was not really budgeted for, because who could anticipate this huge number of well failures since the middle part of 2016? Rates have got to go up. Money has to be found to cover. So I suspect we're going to see higher water rates.
That was Sherry Bracken reporting from the Big Island. She says water rates are on the agenda for the next meeting set for March 27th.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
Today was National Walkout Day at schools across the country. Thousands of students left class at 10 a.m. to remember the recent victims of a shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Students here in Hawaii organize events at their own schools. We sent our producer, Ryan Finnerty, to the University Laboratory School in Honolulu to talk to students. Student body president and senior T. Posiulai introduced the event.
We're not here to protest or support a particular view on the gun control, but we are here to take 17 minutes to honor those who have passed away in the Florida school shooting and bring awareness to what's going on in our country. And while we do understand and value the rights afforded to us as Americans, like freedom of speech and being able to speak your mind, what we value most is life. So please just kind of take this as a reminder to start respecting people, being kind no matter who they are, so we can show our state and national leaders that we will be the generation to bring change.
The walkout lasted 17 minutes, 1 minute for each person who died in the Parkland shooting. Here's what a few students had to say about why they took part today.
I came out today just because the situation in around the nation has been getting worse and worse, and nothing has been happening about it. So it's really just our duty as students, as people, to bring attention to this and to tell people what they what needs to be done.
My name is Bella KSI. I'm in 10th grade. And I came out because I feel like everyone right now, everyone here is supporting a cause to show that with our support and our walkout, we can actually make a change, even though not much things would be done, but we want something to be done. And once we come out, it's going to show that we do care.
We weren't really here to support a certain view on what's going on right now. But I do know that the kids, they kind of like to do their own thing. So we were just here to guide them and make sure that they know why we're here. I'm pretty sure not everyone in our school was aware of all the things that are really happening right now. So I hope this is just to educate them and bringing them out here, they can see, like, what's actually happening in our world.
Those were 10th graders Seth and Valika, and Laboratory School student body president, 12th grader T. Pusi Ulai. The walkout was student organized, but couldn't have taken place without the support of the school's administration.
We were instantly happy to support them. We wanted to give them a safe place, and we wanted it to be student-run, and everything really was. We took a step back. We were just there for guidance and support. I was really impressed with our students between the really creative and thoughtful signs that they made, the way they shared information prior, ahead of time, with all the grade levels from K to 12. And then I think what really struck me was I don't think I've ever heard them so silent during a moment of silence. And I think that really hit home to me that this is something that is very important to them. Because I know if I asked them to be that quiet in a classroom, they would never be that quiet. And so to see them do that on their own, it actually spoke volumes, the silence.
That was Laura Cottingham, the vice principal at the University Laboratory School. She spoke with us just after the conclusion of the walkout. A separate rally organized by students from several high schools will take place 9 a.m. on March 24th at Ala Moana Beach Park here in Honolulu. You can find details at the conversation page on hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we talk to the Armed Forces Control Board following the spate of high-profile crimes in Waikiki as a police chief calls for rolling back on cabaret hours. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.